Welcome to the Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming on the web for the world at www.kpfk.org. This is Tammy Bang Liu, and I'm here with my co-host, Damon Azali. So the top of the hour, we're going to be speaking to Larry Aubrey, columnist for Los Angeles Sentinel. He's a member of the Committee to Save King Drew Medical Center, the Reparations United Front, as well as the Inglewood School Board. And Larry's going to talk to us about the current state and future of the Black Left and progressive movement in Los Angeles. And just last week, a federal immigration judge dismissed the government's 20-year deportation attempt of Michelle Shahadeh and Hutter Hamid, two of the Los Angeles Eight. And since 1987, the LA 8 has been targeted by the government for deportation based on allegations of their involvement with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Joining us today will be Michelle and his attorney, Mark De La Hood. Stay tuned and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines. This is Damon Azali, and we're being joined on the phone right now by Larry Aubrey. Larry, welcome to the show.
Okay, all right. How are you?
Good. So one of the things that I think is really important to translate to folks of the younger generation, like myself, who weren't there in the kind of height of Black Power and the Black Liberation Movement of the 60s, is basically how can we understand what that movement was like and how can we then recreate it? So starting from that, why don't you give us a little sense about what vantage point you were at that point? What were you doing in the movement? What were you doing in terms of your, you know, very long struggle to win rights for Black people and all people of color?
Well, I started as far as directly involved with the movement in probably about 1960, but I was indirectly involved from early on. I came here to Los Angeles in 1942. Los Angeles was just as segregated as New Orleans, which was de jure segregation in the South. But in any case, I was involved. I was involved, you know, with sort of demonstrations. I did some stuff with CORE and whatnot. But I was working. In 1960, I started as a probation officer. So my full-time gig was working with the juveniles and adults and narcotics addicts and stuff like that. But basically, I mean, it was another kind of time, you know. But remember, that was the culmination. The 60s was really the culmination. Things really started, you know, way back, 20s, 30s, and 40s, of course, in World War II was pivotal, you know. The people went to war, mostly young men, but not all men. Some women were just absolutely tired of the crap. African Americans were just tired of the way the country was treating them when they got back. So these things culminated. And, of course, we had the Brown decision, you know, the Brown versus the Board, which, ironically, he didn't do much, really, frankly, in my opinion. But that's another issue. Maybe we'll talk about it later. So anyway, it was a different kind of time. That time has not been replicated. It's not been we haven't seen that. I haven't seen the fervor of the young people, frankly, that I saw back then. But I'm not so sure that I have any full answers for that. But it's a different kind of thing. And the needs, incidentally, in the African-American community are greater than ever. Greater than ever. There's no question about that.
Right. I mean, I think that's the interesting thing. A lot of times I say the conditions are different now than they were then. I think they look a little different, but if you look at police brutality, if you look at disenfranchising of Black people, if you look at the war, I mean, there are a lot of similarities. The one thing that I think is inherently different, if you even go back to, you know, Scottsboro Boys, the 20s, the 40s, you know, on back down the line, the difference I see now is that there's not a movement. And there's not a movement to actually push a lot of the power controllers, the people who are in power, into the right direction.
Right.
So in relation to that, what do you see as some of the key things that are missing, or some of the key things that we can actually hone into to actually transform what the movement is today to some glimmers, or potentially, hopefully, better than it was in the 60s, 50s, 40s, et cetera?
You know, I'm not a doomsayer, naysayer either, for that matter, but I got to tell you, I write, you know, I've been writing for 20 years in the Sentinel columns, and, you know, my stuff is basically geared to African Americans, Blacks, and it borders on, as far as some people are concerned, it borders on sort of negative. That's not the intent. The intent is to paint reality. Reality is composed of both negative and positive, right? And I'm going to tell you something. I am not hopeful that in the near term, we will be able to turn the our sort of resurrect the movement or even develop a new one. I'm going to tell you one major factor that you didn't mention in terms of what was happening then, what's happening now. I didn't mention it until now. Is that the black middle class has basically cut loose, okay, from the struggle. Now I say that in quotes, of course, because nobody can cut loose entirely. But it's important to understand that the black middle class, you know, or people who were aspiring to be middle class, were people that were pushing the thing in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. Do you understand? Whereas now, I mean, you know, it's almost like, well, not almost like, the chasm between the black middle class and poorer blacks is greater than ever in history. Okay? Now we understand the reasons for that because you had more access than in the past and stuff like that. But in terms of actually fueling helping to fuel a new movement or the movement, right? I haven't seen that. And I must tell you, and I'll talk about it a bit of it later. I talk a lot about black leadership in my pieces, and I know quite a few people, as you probably do, in leadership positions. And I think the leadership, generally speaking, in the African American community is horrendous, absolutely horrendous.
So, I mean, that was, you're like reading my mind. The next question I had for you is, you know, who do you see as black leadership in Los Angeles at this current point? And then, within that broad spectrum, what are the different political camps you would...
But within, you said, who do I see as what? I'm sorry.
As black leadership in Los Angeles at this point.
Well, you know, that's a good question. There are people who are in leadership positions. The positions are high-level positions. High-level in the sense of they may have control a lot of staff or they're high-level in terms of the organizations they work for. But, you see, I consider black leadership much more amorphous than that in a sense. So it's quite specific. I mean, it's quite, black leadership, as far as I'm concerned, is in the schools, or should be in the schools. It's all over the place. And it isn't just the so-called leaders. We have economic leaders. You have the Magic Johnsons who are leaders by virtue of their money. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. That's going on all the time. But as far as I'm concerned, the leaders, people that, for example, the LA Times designates as leaders, you know, these so-called, you know, community activists that every time you look on the tube, you see them on there, right? Almost without exception. And those people to me are not leaders, okay? Although I must say, and I see the leadership question being critical, but it's also a question which is being unattended. We have elected officials, for example, who do what the hell they want to do, it seems to me, when they want to do it, okay? And are accountable. Yes, they're accountable at the ballot box. That's ultimate accountability as far as they're concerned. But the fact of the matter is their ears not to the what's going on in their own, with their own constituents and so forth. But listen, we have educators that have let black children down. You know, we've had police that have let everybody else down. I mean black police. I'm telling you, we have as far as I'm concerned, there's a crisis of black leadership in the community.
That's definitely, I mean, if you folks, I just encourage you as a different voice to actually pick up the Sentinel, because I think what you were just saying about the LA Times, I mean, we were, a couple of my friends and I were joking about the other day, is just like, you know, they'll follow the mayor as he drinks, he drank a cup of water today. Whereas, you know, you'll bring 350 people to the steps of City Hall and it's not even... they don't cover protests. So I think that's very, very important in terms of how power is seen and who has power within the city.
Yeah.
So I think the interesting thing that you were saying, just bringing it back to if you say the middle class, or if you say the upper middle class, or people like Magic Johnson, et cetera, or whatnot,
that's not the middle class.
right. Definitely very clear. Very clear in that. What are some of the issues that class that I guess has risen out of the black community as opposed with the black community? What are some of the things that they're actually fighting on, and what are some of the things that they just say, okay, I'm not going to even touch that because that's against my interests?
Right. Well, you know, I'm going to tell you something. I mean, I think, you know, and that's why even the black community, you know, is obviously, you know, a real broad stroke, and it can be misleading, it can be even inaccurate. I rarely use the term black community. I talk about black communities because I think that's more accurate, and I think we can deal better with what's happening. But there are many things going down. I mean, you mentioned about the issue, you asked about the issues. The issues remain, some of these issues are bedrock issues. For example, education. The black child is on the bottom of the ladder. Is anybody jumping up and down about that? it's a rhetorical question. I'm not asking you to answer that question, obviously, but I would say not really. Okay, I've been involved with for a long time with not only with LAUSD but with other districts. I was actually on the school board in Inglewood for 9 years, and it doesn't mean that I know anything more than anybody else. It's just that I've been exposed to so much stuff. But I'm telling you right now, it has to do. I think that without being a cliche, doing a cliche thing, it's important. I think it's important to really sort of acknowledge and then keep going and recognize it, that racism is still alive and well, and that the black child is still on the bottom. The closer you are to black on the racist continuum, the worse off you are. And conversely, the closer you are to the white folks are, then the better off you are. Now, I think that sounds a simplistic and old-time issue, but I'm going to tell you something. I think it's still alive and well. I think that's what these suits are all about with these things. And there's other things happening. And you mentioned issues. So issues are employment in the black community. Real employment. We've got tremendous issues there in employment. We have immigration as an issue, as a plus and a minus. A plus for those folks who are coming over wanting a better life, needing a better life, and that's cool. In the meantime, a lot of black folks that feel that's happening at their expense. That's another issue.
Let's stop there, because that was one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. Because you have been a co-convener of the Black Latino Roundtable, the Black Korean Alliance,
right,
the Multicultural Collaborative. Clearly, you know, if anybody reads your work, you see that you're very black-centered, black-focused, but also understanding that it needs to be connections, right?
Right.
So I think the question I would ask you then, first, why, and then secondly, how Latinos should support the expansion of rights for black people, and then vice versa.
I am hardly in a position to answer that question, but I can only talk about it from a black perspective. And incidentally, all the work I've done through the years has been just that, with the black perspective. In other words, to me, groups have to have their act together, so to speak, in order to effectively collaborate with others. That's been my motto. It's been my marching orders for myself for many years. In other words, I don't believe in just coalitions for coalition's sake. I'm not interested in running around a circle with somebody and shaking hands and all that. I'm not concerned with that. I'm concerned with mutual respect. I'm concerned with mutual activity, collaboration around mutually agreed upon issues. And that kind of thing. And I tell you right now that, right, it's just not happening across the board. Even in labor. Let's talk about labor just for a moment. I'm a lifelong labor member, basically. But labor, I mean, black folks are not at the decision-making table in labor, except for a few. You've got a few guys running around. You've got people with high-level positions, like Tyrone Freeman, for example, who has 434. Begin to think, 120,000 members or something. And that's cool. Hey, that's fine. That's not the issue. But I am telling you that, generally speaking, hey, man, they're playing, way in the back of the band. They're way back there, see? And I'm saying that's true. I mentioned education. You can talk about it in terms of housing. I'm telling you that this state breaks down still on the basis of color, and that's the thing we keep ducking as we move into the 21st century.
So then in terms of that and the spectrum between Latino and black and whatnot, what would be your wish for the Latino movement to actually support black folks?
My thing is that we'd come together, people would come together, it's sort of a modest wish, really, but that people would actually come together, agree on something, an issue, one or more issues, and on the basis of that agreement, they could hold each other accountable because they've agreed to something, and that could grow. Whoever comes in, buys into that particular model, okay, is part of it, they agree to it, and they can go. Now, the reason that's necessary for race relations and ethnic relations as opposed to other areas is because in other areas, including education and you name it, labor unions and everything else, those parameters are all set. The purpose of the organization is clear, and all those things are clear. It's real clear as to what can happen and what can't happen, et cetera, with the rules and regulations and blah, blah, blah. What I'm really saying to you is that I think it's important that black and Latinos, okay, sit down and agree on something and then maintain. And this has to be sustained. And it can grow. And we've done that for a while, although most of the efforts I've been involved in have not been successful, frankly. It's because people on both sides weren't honest at the table and had other priorities, and so it didn't work. But I mean, as a matter of fact, you may or may not know that Black Latino roundtable thing in the 80s that I did actually, which just started, that involved a couple of co-chairs. There were Antonio Villaraigosa and Mark Ridley Thomas, which was an interesting pair back then, right? And more intimate, what's his name? Villaraigosa was his name was VR, and he hadn't yet married, or he hadn't taken his wife's name anyway. And he worked for, at that point, he was with UTLA. So, I mean, a lot of people, of course, I don't know that. But my point is that even that kind, with those particular players, that didn't work. Because priorities are also a priority with the unions, that's where they work, a priority with this and that. And I understand all that. But what I'm really telling you is that the more we fail to come together, the more the quote-unquote system wins. And the more we almost just like we become complicit in our own demise. We could become complicit in the oppression that we saw at war.
Well, it's interesting, you know, kind of flipping back what you may or may not know. Antonio Villaraigosa was actually part of the group that helped start the Labor Community Strategy Center, which I work for.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah.
we can see how kind of, you know, quote unquote, how they would say the best and the brightest get kind of swooped up and encouraged to do other things, right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
If I look at, you know, in terms of both the people you just talked about, in terms of Mark Riley Thomas and the prison guards and whatnot,
yeah.
In terms of Antonio, and I think this is one of the issues that both black and Latinos can agree on is the stuff around police brutality. And Antonio right now is trying to, you know, get more and more money to
uh-huh.
get more and more cops. And I know particularly
yeah.
you were, you know, doing a lot of work with community call to action and accountability that was focused on justice for Devin Brown.
Right, true.
That's, to me, is one of the clearest, like, root issues beyond anything else
mm-hmm.
is the stuff around prison and policing. Because when
mm-hmm.
you're saying about education, the other thing is, you know,
right.
the city attorney is saying, you know, I've never met a gangster or a gang member that wasn't truant, so we want to crack down on truancy.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in that whole piece...
He's never met a gangster that was other than black or brown.
Right, right, because, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think in terms of that whole piece, there's a lot of different ways to frame that. So folks who don't know,
yeah.
you know, 2 years ago, Devin Brown, 13-year-old black boy, unarmed, was in a Toyota Corolla, got shot through the side by a officer, Stephen Garcia, who was a Latino. And basically the police commission said, that, you know, it was out of policy, but then he got cleared in the secret kind of coats, secret kind of, you know, discipline hearing.
Right.
Some
well,
of the...
Incidentally, I must tell you, because I'm very familiar with this, of course, I must tell you that secret hearing business, the Board of Rights is one thing. It's bad enough. You have two cops and a civilian that deals with discipline cases for LAPD. But let me tell you something. That came down. That's the result of a decision last summer in San Diego. The press. I can't think of the name of the press. Oh, yeah, Copley Press. Versus San Diego Superior Court. What I'm saying is that was open until recently. Those and it was Delgadillo that told the that recommended and they bought it that the police commission ought to be. I'm sorry that the LAPD hold its hearings in private. And the decision of the court did not even deal with hearings. It dealt with documents. Okay, they chose to interpret it, to give it the halo effect, and say that it was much broader than that. So I'm only pointing that out because again, here we go again. These systems that seem to be skewed, you know, to favor the, you know, the establishment and what have you. I mean, that's still it's so true that it's sickening almost, to be honest with you, because we always have to fight for the damn crumbs just to get even, and the system perpetuates itself, et cetera, et cetera. And it goes beyond the color thing because we're talking here about people and systems and processes that simply are choking. I mean, you know, poor people and those of color. I think.
Right. So even within this is one of the dilemmas I'm trying to find out around the police, not
mm-hmm.
find out. I have a lot of thoughts up, but wanting to get your thoughts on. So there is this clear need that people want to feel safe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what is perpetuated in the media, I mean, over the last 20 years in the expansion of prisons is like super predators, et cetera, et cetera. You need more cops. You need more prisons. This is how it's going to make safe. I actually read it the other day in the L.A. Times. That now that, you know, there's 172,000 people in California jails, they're trying to force transfer thousands of people to private facilities, you know, around the country.
Mm-hmm. And juveniles back to the county.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the dilemmas in saying to the black community is saying, how do we actually present an alternative form of rehabilitative justice that makes people accountable for things that they do, but then also the answer is not more suppression, more cops, et
right.
cetera, et cetera.
Right. right. I hear you.
What's your suggestion?
Well, I think whatever it is, and I will answer in a second here. But it, you know, all of this, it seems to me, this is like a template almost. You can put these same ingredients, and yet the needs are there. And how do you deal with education, which is failing our children? How do you deal with the police abuse thing? It's just and so forth. So it all turns out. I've come to believe, and I'll say this, and it's not in any way meaning to skirt around that, but I think that my folks at least are not sufficiently dissatisfied at this point to behave differently. Now that's a hell of a statement in some way, but I don't mean that's not a.
I think that's true,
but what I'm saying is that it just means that the task is more difficult. It doesn't mean that you give up the task by any sense. As a matter of fact, it really goes me to do even more if I can, because I'm a very selfish fellow, you know. I'm self-interest is very important to me, so I'm not an altruist, you know what I mean? But get back to your question. I think that it's going to take ultimately, people dissatisfaction, people motivation. That's dissatisfaction being translated into organizing. Frankly, I think organizing is the key to this, much of this. We can't do it, but we have to have an informed, motivated community in order to change things. I've been down with groups to including CCAA, Community Call to Action Accountability. Been down to the police commission any number of times. I'm telling you, a lot of that is a waste of time. Okay? It just is. Don't get me wrong. Not that demonstrating is a waste of time necessarily, but it has to be strategic. You know, you got things to do. You have to really make sure that you get the bang for your buck, meaning that you establish you and you define the agenda as to how to best deal with these things. Now, I think organizing is very important. And I think getting back to an earlier question, the Black, Latino, and so forth, it extends to other groups. I think that as we get, you know, stuff together in terms of strategic agendas, internally, then we can do it externally better. Sometimes we don't have a choice. Things happen, crises happen, we all sort of come together on those. That's the exception, I understand that. But I want to tell you something. These people running around the streets, like even in Harbor Gate, you know the Harbor Gate bit? You think, you know, out there with Cheryl Green, the 14-year-old that was killed, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Hey, let me tell you something, man. You got guys running there making things worse, dangerous. These guys, I call them peripatetic ambulance chasers. I mean, these guys are nuts, man, and people don't call them out. The whole notion of accountability is more rhetoric than it is reality. Okay, so that's, you know, and I'm saying, so we need to get at least start with a few people who agree on ABC, and then take ABC and other people buy into that, and we grow that, we make that larger and a potential force, a potential influence as it relates to issues we mutually define. But I don't think you can do it. I mean, I've been in many, many attempts at coalitions and this and that and the other. And I don't think you can just being motivated is not sufficient. You've got to have an agenda. You've got to have some support, and then we'll move. That's my cut on it.
I mean, I think definitely I underscore the strategic vision. I think that's one of the things that, you know, in this terms of this show, we try to bring together people who have a strategic vision, so it's not just kind of, you know, winning the small things, but saying like, well, how is this striking a blow against this? How is this winning more rights for you?
Right.
So everybody, where, you know, this is KPFK 90.7. This is Voices from the Frontlines, Damon Ozzoli and Tenbang Liu. And we're speaking to Larry Aubrey, and we have about three more minutes. And this kind of strategic question is around this particular thing I want to talk to you about, because I know you've also been very vocal against the war.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I read, I got it off the line somewhere, but it was saying how basically, this is one of your quotes, sustained collective action is essential to countering the right. Witness the nation's putrid reaction, ratifying the president's despicable, unjustified invasion of Iraq and the senseless killing of thousands and thousands of people. I mean, to me, this seems like this is the clearest example of how this world is going to eat itself up and destroy itself up.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see, you know, besides, you know, a couple here and there in terms of the Black community actually standing up against this, you know, where do we need to...
Well, damn it, let me say this. I know we're just about out of time, but let me just say to you, my friend, we have to acknowledge, you know, what exists, number one. We have to take evidence. We have to hold people accountable. We got to jump off this rhetoric thing. And as far as the war is concerned, those same elements, those same factors I talked about earlier in relation to dealing with local problems obtained with the national problems. I mean, the black voice, for the most part, has been silent in this whole thing. Now, that's an overstatement. I understand that. People will say, well, wait a minute, I haven't. There are people who have done it. But let me tell you, it's the same kind of thing. We've got a pretty good contingency of blacks in there, and Latinos for them. I mean, in the Congress, let's see what happens. The California Black Caucus did issue a report last week. Maybe that's helpful. I guess, I hope that's the start. My piece is, Nadelia, this week in the Sentinel relates to, again, to leadership, and it reflects the same kind of stuff we're talking about right now. So if you get a chance, check it out. It's coming Thursday.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is, if there ends up being, I mean, this whole voice about voice or silence or whatever, I think there is, but I think one of the key things that you know, bringing back to what you said in the middle, the beginning of the interview, is like the people who have that voice and have the access to that voice besides on KPFK and whatnot is kind of this middle class that has been bought off by the spoils of imperialism. And so therefore don't want to actually challenge the actual policies and principles that give them their legitimacy.
Broad people moving on the system, unfortunately, is moving on themselves. That's a heck of a – that's one of the most insidious legacies of slavery. But we can get past that, you know, once we become sufficiently dissatisfied to get and develop. We have to develop ourselves an agenda. And that's going to be very difficult, but it's got to happen. It's got to happen. Otherwise, you're going to succumb to the crap.
With that, thank you, Larry, for being on the show.
All right, Damon.
Well, I'm sure I'm going to see you around somewhere.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Tell me a little something.
Talk to you later.
All right.
Bye-bye.
So this is Tambang Lu, and this is actually Damon Azali with Tambang Lu. We're going to a break, and we'll be right back with Michelle Shaheda of the LA 8s and his lawyer, Mark Mandarin. We'll be right back after this break.